This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to find out how you can volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The History of England, from the Accession of James II by Thomas Babington Macaulay. Book 1, Chapter 3, Part 9. England, however, was not in the 17th century destitute of watering places. The gentry of Derbyshire and of the neighbouring counties repaired to Buxton, where they were lodged in low rooms under bare rafters, and regaled with oatcake and with viand, which the hosts call mutton, but which the guests suspected to be dog. A single good house stood near the spring, Tunbridge Wells, lying within a day's journey of the capital, and in one of the richest and most highly civilized parts of the kingdom, had much greater attractions. At present we see there a town which would, 160 years ago, have ranked in population fourth or fifth among the towns of Britain. The brilliancy of the shops and the luxury of the private dwellings far surpasses anything that England could then show. When the court, soon after the Restoration, visited Tunbridge Wells, there was no town, but within a mile of the spring rustic cottages, somewhat cleaner and neater than the ordinary cottages of that time, were scattered over the heath. Some of these cabins were movable, and were carried on sledges from one part of the common to another. To these huts men of fashion, wearied with the din and smoke of London, sometimes came in the summer to breathe fresh air and catch a glimpse of rural life. During the season, a kind of fair was daily held near the fountain. The wives and daughters of the Kentish farmers came from the neighbouring villages with cream, cherries, wheatears and quails, to chaffer with them, to flirt with them, to praise their straw hats and tight heels, was a refreshing pastime to voluptuaries sick of the airs of actresses and maids of honour. Milliners, toymen and jewellers came down from London and opened a bazaar under the trees. In one booth the politician might find his coffee and the London Gazette. In another were gamblers playing deep at basset, and on fine evenings the fiddles were in attendance, and there were Morris dancers on the elastic turf of the bowling green. In 1685 a subscription had just been raised among those who frequented the Wells for building a church, which the Tories, who then domineered everywhere, insist on dedicating to St. Charles the Martyr. But at the head of the English watering places, without a rival, was Bath. The springs of that city had been renowned from the days of the Romans. It had been, during many centuries, the seat of a bishop. The sick repaired thither from every part of the realm. The king sometimes held his court there. Nevertheless, Bath was then a maze of only 400 or 500 houses, crowded within an old wall in the vicinity of the Avon. Pictures of what were considered as the finest of those houses are still extant, and greatly resemble the lowest rag shops and pot houses of Ratcliffe Highway. Travellers, indeed, complained loudly of the narrowness and meanness of the streets. That beautiful city, which charms even eyes familiar with the masterpieces of Bramante and Palladio, and which the genius of Anstey and of Smollett, and of Francis Burney and of Jane Austen, has made classic ground, had not begun to exist. Milsom Street itself was an open field lying far beyond the walls, and hedgerows intersected the space which is now covered by the Crescent and the Circus. The poor patients to whom the waters had been recommended lay on straw in a place which, to use the language of a contemporary physician, was a covert rather than a lodging. As to the comforts and luxuries which were to be found in the interior of the houses of Bath by the fashionable visitors who resorted thither in search of health or amusement, we possess information more complete and minute than can generally be obtained on such subjects. A writer who published an account of that city about 60 years after the Revolution has accurately described the changes which had taken place within his own recollection. He assures us that, in his younger days, the gentleman who visited the springs slept in rooms hardly as good as the garrets which he lived to see occupied by footmen. The floors of the dining room were uncarpeted, and were coloured brown with a wash made of soot and small beer in order to hide the dirt. Not a wainscot was painted, not a hearth or a chimney-piece was of marble. A slab of common freestone and fire irons, which had cost from 3 to 4 shillings, were thought sufficient for any fireplace. The best apartments were hung with coarse woollen stuff, and were furnished with rush-bottomed chairs. Readers who take an interest in the progress of civilization and of the useful arts will be grateful to the humble topographer who has recorded these facts, and will perhaps wish that historians of far higher pretensions had sometimes spared a few pages from military evolutions and political intrigues for the purpose of letting us know how the parlours and bedchambers of our ancestors looked. The position of London, relatively to the other towns of the empire, was in the time of Charles II far higher than at present. For at present the population of London is little more than 6 times the population of Manchester or of Liverpool. In the days of Charles II, the population of London was more than 17 times the population of Bristol or of Norwich. It may be doubted whether any other instance can be mentioned of a great kingdom in which the first city was more than 17 times as large as the second. There is reason to believe that, in 1685, London had been, during about half a century, the most populous capital in Europe. The inhabitants, who are now at least 1,900,000, were then probably little more than 500,000. London had in the world only one commercial rival, now long ago outstripped the mighty and opulent Amsterdam. English writers boasted of the forests of masts and yardarms which covered the river from the bridge to the tower, and of the stupendous sums which were collected at the Customs House in Thames Street. There is, indeed, no doubt that the trade of the metropolis then bore a far greater proportion than at present to the whole trade of the country. Yet to our generation the honest vaunting of our ancestors must appear almost ludicrous. The shipping which they thought incredibly great appears not to have exceeded 70,000 tons. This was indeed, then, more than a third of the whole tonnage of the kingdom, but is now less than a fourth of the tonnage of Newcastle, and is nearly equalled by the tonnage of the steam vessels of the Thames. The customs of London amounted in 1685 to about £330,000 a year. In our time, the net duty paid annually at the same place exceeds 10 millions. Whoever examines the maps of London which were published towards the close of the reign of Charles II will see that only the nucleus of the present capital then existed. The town did not, as now, fade by imperceptible degrees into the country. No long avenues of villas embowered in lilacs and laburnums extended from the great centre of wealth and civilization almost to the boundaries of Middlesex and far into the heart of Kent and Surrey. In the east, no part of the immense line of warehouses and artificial lakes which now stretches from the Tower to Blackwall had even been projected. On the west, scarcely one of those stately piles of buildings which are inhabited by the noble and wealthy was in existence. And Chelsea, which is now peopled by more than 40,000 human beings, was a quiet country village with about 1,000 inhabitants. On the north, cattle fed and sportsmen wandered with dogs and guns over the site of the borough of Marylebone. And over far the greater of the space now covered by the boroughs of Finsbury and of the Tower Hamlets. Islington was almost a solitude, and poets loved to contrast its silence and repose with din and turmoil of the monster London. On the south, the capital is now connected with its suburb by several bridges, not inferior in magnificence and solidity to the noblest works of the Caesars. In 1685, a single line of irregular arches overhung by piles of mean and crazy houses, and garnished after a fashion worthy of the naked barbarians of Dahomey, with scores of mouldering heads, impeded the navigation of the river. Of the metropolis, the city, properly so called, was the most important division. At the time of the Restoration, it had been built, the most part, of wood and plaster. The few bricks that were used were ill-baked. The booths where goods were exposed to sale projected far into the streets, and were overhung by the upper stories. Few specimens of this architecture may still be seen in those districts which were not reached by the Great Fire. That fire had, in a few days, covered a space of little less than a square mile with the ruins of 89 churches and of 13,000 houses. But the city had risen again with a celerity which had excited the admiration of neighbouring countries. Unfortunately, the old lines of the streets had been to a great extent preserved, and those lines, originally traced in an age where even princes performed their journeys on horseback, were often too narrow to allow wheeled carriages to pass each other with ease, and were therefore ill adapted for the residence of wealthy persons in an age when a coach and six was a fashionable luxury. The style of building was, however, far superior to that of the city which had perished. The ordinary material was brick, of much better quality than had been formerly used. On the sites of the ancient parish churches had arisen a multitude of new domes, towers, and spires, which bore the mark of the fertile genius of Wren. In every place, save one, the traces of the great devastation had been completely effaced. But the crowds of workmen, the scaffolds, and the masses of hewn stone were still to be seen where the noblest of Protestant temples was slowly rising on the ruins of the old cathedral of St. Paul. The whole character of the city has, since that time, undergone a complete change. At present, the bankers, the merchants, and the chief shopkeepers repair thither on 6 mornings of every week for the transaction of business, but they reside in other quarters of the metropolis, or at suburban country seats surrounded by shrubberies and flower gardens. This revolution in private habits has produced a political revolution of no small importance. The city is no longer regarded by the wealthiest traders with that attachment which every man naturally feels for his home. It is no longer associated in their minds with domestic affections and endearments. The fireside, the nursery, the social table, the quiet bed are not there. Lombard Street and Threadneedle Street are merely places where men toil and accumulate. They go elsewhere to enjoy and to expend on a Sunday, or in an evening after the hours of business, some courts and alleys which a few hours before had been alive with hurrying feet and anxious faces are as silent as the glades of a forest. The chiefs of the mercantile interest are no longer citizens. They avoid, they almost contemn, municipal honours and duties. Those honours and duties are abandoned to men who, though useful and highly respectable, seldom belong to the princely commercial houses of which the names are renowned throughout the world. In the 17th century, the city was the merchant's residence. Those mansions of the great old burghers, which still exist, have been turned into counting houses and warehouses. But it is evident that they were originally not inferior in magnificence to the dwellings which were then inhabited by the nobility. They sometimes stand in retired and gloomy courts, and are accessible only by inconvenient passages, but their dimensions are ample, and their aspect stately. The entrances are decorated with richly carved pillars and canopies. The staircases and landing places are not wanting in grandeur. The floors are sometimes of wood, tessellated after the fashion of France. The palace of Sir Robert Clayton in the Old Jewry contained a superb banqueting room, wainscoted with cedar and adorned with battles of gods and giants in fresco. Sir Dudley North expended £4,000, a sum which would then have been important to a duke, on the rich furniture of his reception rooms in Basinghall Street. In such abodes, under the last Stuarts, the heads of the great firms lived splendidly and hospitably. To their dwelling place they were bound by the strongest ties of interest and affection. There they had passed their youth, had made their friendships, had courted their wives, had seen their children grow up, had laid the remains of their parents in the earth, and expected that their own remains would be laid. That intense patriotism, which is peculiar to the members of societies congregated within a narrow space, was, in such circumstances, strongly developed. London was to the Londoner what Athens was to the Athenian of the age of Pericles, what Florence was to the Florentine of the 15th century. The citizen was proud of the grandeur of his city, punctilious about her claim to respect, ambitious of her officers, and zealous for her franchises. End of Part 9.